Hi everyone, before we get started with the episode, I would just really like a favor. If you're listening to this and you are a pilot or you're just like a really passionate fan of air crashes, I'd really love to have you on the podcast. So if you are interested in that type of stuff, being on the podcast and everything, then just DM me on Instagram at ACI_THE_podcast. And yes, maybe you can be a part of our next episode. Thank you. Hi, my name is Kai, and welcome back to Air Crash Investigation, the podcast, the show where we dissect and discuss prominent crashes in aviation history. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the story of Japan Airlines Flight 123. So without wasting any more of your time, because this is about to be a long one, let us get into it.
It's the greatest aviation mystery of all time. Lies a massive passenger jet and the remains of its 239 passengers and crew.
Good morning. We have a smoke problem. And we're doing emergency descent to level 15140.
In December 1988, a passenger airliner was bombed over Scotland in what was one of the largest pre-9/11 terrorist attacks.
Japan Airlines Flight 123 was a scheduled flight for the 12th of August 1985. Its origin was Haneda International Airport, now known as Tokyo Haneda International Airport in Tokyo, Japan, and its destination was Itami International Airport or Osaka Itami International Airport, Osaka, Japan. And I just have to stop right here just to give a little bit of a PSA. When it comes to this episode, most of the things that I'm going to be referring to in terms of towns and cities that are in Japan, I'm going to be referring to the ones that I found in the final report, which you can find on our Patreon. And I'm pretty sure that most of them did change over the past couple of years. So apologies for that, and hopefully it doesn't take you away from this episode. So the aircraft in operation was the Boeing 747-SR-46, and the call sign was Japan Air 123 or JAL 123. The captain of this flight was Masumi Takahama, who was 49 years old. He joined the airline on the 1st of December 1966. He then received his pilot's license on the 4th of July 1969. Takahama was able to fly a land single, land multiple YS-11 Boeing 727 and the DC-8. He became a qualified captain on the 16th of June 1977, aka Youth Day in South Africa, and his medical certificate was valid until the 18th of January 1986. In total, Captain Takahama had 12,423 flight hours, with 4,842 of those hours on the accident aircraft type. His latest proficiency test was performed on the 28th of June 1985 and his route check on the 5th of February 1985. The first officer was Yutaka Sasaki, who was 39 years old at the time of the crash. He joined the airline on the 18th of April 1970 and he received his pilot's license on the 20th of June 1984. Sasaki was able to fly a land single aircraft, land multiple aircraft and the DC-8. His medical certificate was valid until the 11th of November 1985. First Officer Sasaki had 3,963 total flight hours, and within those hours, 2,665 were on the Boeing 747. Yutaka Sasaki's latest route check was performed on the 19th of July 1985. Finally, the flight engineer was Hiroshi Fukuda, who was 46 years old. He joined Japan Airlines on the 1st of April 1957 and he received his flight engineer's license on the 8th of September 1965. Fukuda was able to fly the DC-6, Boeing 727 and the DC-8. His medical certificate was valid until the 11th of November 1985. In total, Flight Engineer Fukuda had 9,831 flight hours with 3,846 hours on the accident aircraft type. Finally, his latest route check was performed on the 27th of August 1984. In a normal flight, the captain would be sitting in the left side of the cockpit and the first officer slash co-pilot on the right. However, due to the fact that First Officer Sasaki was being trained by Captain Takahama, he was sitting on the left and the captain was sitting on the right. There were 487 passengers on board from different parts of the world. Also, the reason as to why there were a lot of passengers on board is because the flight took place during Japan's holiday season. So for me, honestly, it breaks my heart a little bit more. There were 12 flight attendants on board and they were all trained properly. The aircraft, as I had mentioned, was the Boeing 747. This aircraft, to be specific, was manufactured on the 30th of January 1974. This aircraft had a total of 25,030 flight hours and 18,835 total landings. The maintenance schedule for Boeing aircraft goes as follows. There's A maintenance, which is maintenance that has to be done for every 250 flying hours of the aircraft, and C maintenance, which is maintenance that needs to be done every 3,000 hours. This airplane did undergo a scheduled maintenance, but there was an incident in 1978 that caused some damage to the aircraft. On the 2nd of July 1978, Japan Airlines Flight 115 bounced heavily whilst landing at Itami International Airport. The second bounce caused a severe tail strike, and according to Boeing themselves, a tail strike occurs when an airplane tail contacts the runway during takeoff or landing. So due to this incident, there were 50 injuries, but luckily no fatalities. The tail strike resulted in the aft pressure bulkhead cracking. This part is located by the rear end of the aircraft between the 17th of June to the 11th of July 1978, which is too long in my opinion, but I digress. After the aircraft was fixed, it was returned to service, so keep this information at the back of your head. Japan Airlines Flight 366 landed at Tokyo Haneda International Airport at 12 minutes past 5 p.m. After all the passengers and crew disembarked, the next flight on this aircraft became Japan Airlines Flight 123. The aircraft was on the ground for about an hour before taking off from runway 15 left at 12 minutes past 6 p.m. The crew at this point was 12 minutes behind schedule. At 16 minutes past 6 p.m., Japan Airlines Flight 123 was climbing to 24,000 feet or 7,350 meters when they asked the Tokyo Area Air Traffic Control to give them permission to fly directly to Sea Perch. And at 18 minutes past 6 p.m., the route was approved by the controller. At 24 minutes past 6 p.m., the flight was approaching their cruising altitude of 24,000 feet or 7,315 meters when the crew and their passengers heard a loud boom. As soon as they heard this boom, the pilots broadcasted a distress signal to the air traffic controller. After they broadcasted the signal, Captain Takahama contacted the Tokyo Air Traffic Controller to declare an emergency and to request to go back to Haneda International Airport. The air traffic controller confirms the declaration of the emergency and they ask, "What is the nature of the emergency?" And there was no response. The air traffic controller approved the crew to turn east back to Haneda using the heading 090 degrees. The aircraft started to deviate from their flight path by entering a right-hand bank angle of 40 degrees. Captain Takahama ordered First Officer Sasaki to reduce the aircraft's bank angle, but the aircraft was not responding to the commands. Reason being, the hydraulic lines which controlled the control panel were severed due to a decompression of the airplane. Flight engineer Fukuda stated that the hydraulic pressure of the aircraft was dropping. As they were trying to solve that problem, the autopilot disengaged, which meant that the crew needed to manually fly the airplane. The airplane at this point virtually became uncontrollable, so Captain Takahama ordered First Officer Sasaki to descend the airplane. The reason why the air traffic controller did not receive a response from the crew when they asked what the nature of the emergency was is because hypoxia started to set in the cockpit. And if you have listened to the other episodes, you know that hypoxia is incredibly dangerous. The Tokyo Air Traffic Controller contacted the aircraft again and they were instructing them to take a magnetic course of 90 degrees for radar vector to Oshima. The captain finally answered by saying, but now uncontrol. The aircraft controller finished off by saying, uncontrol, Raja understood. As the flight was passing over Yaizu, Shizuoka, at 29 minutes to 7 p.m., the aircraft controller asked the crew, can you descend? The captain responded by saying, now descending. As the crew was descending, the aircraft controller suggested to the crew, your present position is 72 nautical miles or 133 kilometers or 83 miles from Nagoya Airport. Can you land at Nagoya? And the crew responded by saying, request turn to Haneda, aka they refused to divert to Nagoya and they specifically wanted to land at Haneda. Why? I do not know. So the pilots continued to try and turn the control wheel, pull the control column, and to move the rudder pedals in order to gain some control of the airplane. And this worked for a little bit as they started to turn to the right, about 35 kilometers or 22 miles away from Mount Fuji. As much as they were slowly regaining control, the aircraft was still falling in the 20,000 to 24,000 feet or 6,100 to 7,300 meter range for about 18 minutes. It is said that they probably failed because of the effects of hypoxia at a high altitude. Maybe that is the reason why they failed to respond to the aircraft controller quickly. None of the pilots had their oxygen masks on, even though the flight engineer advised them to. They weren't working, but regardless. At 25 minutes to 7 p.m., flight engineer Fukuda spoke to the aircraft controller and told them that their oxygen masks were not working and that R5 door broke. At 20 minutes to 7 p.m., the crew decided to lower their landing gear so that they could decrease the aircraft's airspeed so that they could land. This action was somewhat successful, but when they lowered the landing gear, it decreased the aircraft's directional control. Flight engineer Fukuda, in preparation to land, asked the other pilots if they should use the speed brakes so that they could land properly and stop in time. However, this was not heard by the rest of the crew. The crew managed to descend from 22,400 feet or 6,800 meters to 17,000 feet or 5,200 meters within 5 minutes, which is not fast if you think about it, but it definitely was in this situation. Whilst they were descending, the aircraft became virtually uncontrollable. Then the airplane started to turn to the left, and luckily, if we could even call it that, a decrease in the aircraft's altitude resulted in more oxygen being available, thus the crew's hypoxia subsided. The pilots could now properly comprehend the seriousness of their situation. The captain low-key gave up when he said, "This may be hopeless." And you know it's bad when a pilot says that it is hopeless to get out of a situation because they already think that they're going to die, which is really unfortunate. At 13 minutes to 7 p.m., the aircraft controller asked, is the aircraft uncontrollable? And the crew responded by saying, uncontrollable. At 12 minutes to 7 p.m., Japan Airlines Flight 123 was over the town of Okutama, and they were at 7,000 feet or 2,100 meters. Their altitude was so low that they were nearing the surrounding mountains, which is a serious problem. The aircraft's low altitude sounded, and at 9 minutes to 7 p.m., the stick shaker started to shake, which basically means that the aircraft is going to get into a stall. The crew saw that their proximity to the mountains was a danger, so they decided to try and increase their thrust so that they could get past the mountains and prevent a stall. This worked, as at 7 minutes to 7 p.m., Japan Airlines Flight 123 was at 13,000 feet or 4,000 meters. The captain at this point says that he cannot control the airplane any longer. And at 6 minutes to 7 p.m., the crew was instructed to change their frequency from the Tokyo Aircraft Controller to the Tokyo Approach Control or Tokyo Approach, which would help them land. The crew extended their flaps to 25 and their bank angle exceeded 60 degrees, which is very, very, very dangerous. Captain Takahama ordered for the flaps to be retracted, and they were. The ground proximity warning system started to sound, but the aircraft's pitch altitude leveled out. Japan Airlines Flight 123's engine number 4 started to hit the trees north-northwest of Mount Mikuni. Then the right wing started to clip the ridge of the mountains, and unfortunately at 4 minutes to 7 p.m., Japan Airlines Flight 123 crashes into Mount Mikuni. Miraculously, Four people survived, but unfortunately, everyone else, including the crew, had died. The investigation was led by the Aircraft Accident Investigation Commission of Japan and, of course, the NTSB of the United States, the AAIB of the UK, and so much more helped in the investigation. The crash site was 1,565 meters or 5,135 feet long on a slope about 2.5 kilometers or 1.55 miles north-northwest of Mount Mikuni. There was a U-turn ditch which was separated from the main crash site by the deep valley. On the slope of the mountain, they found the left and right main landing gear support beam, the skin from the right wing, and the flap trucks. About 110 meters or 361 feet west of the main crash site, the investigators found the nose, left wing, nose wheels, and the main landing wheels of the airplane, which is really weird and concerning. About 200 meters or 656 feet north-northwest of the main crash site, the fuselage portion of the upper deck cabin was found and it was shattered. The U-turn ditch was 570 meters or 1,870 feet southeast of the main crash site. Parts of the right wing tip, the wing skin, and other pieces of fuselage were found in this part of the crash site. Engine number 4, aka the engine that hit the mountain first, was found lying widely scattered between the U-turn ditch and a tree. Some parts of the fuselage were found in the water. Approximately 53 pieces of debris were found and recovered from Sagami Bay and the surrounding locations. The Rescue Coordination Center of Tokyo's Airport Office of Tokyo's Regional Civil Aviation Bureau, or the CC, were the people who first learned about the crash of Japan Airlines Flight 123. So they decided to forward the information to the Iruma Rescue Coordination Center of Air Self-Defense Force and the Maritime Safety Agency so that they could initiate a search and rescue operation. This was done between 27 minutes to 9 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. A fire was also found near the crash site. Now, as I had mentioned, four passengers survived this crash. They were seated on the left-hand side of the aircraft, aka near the center of seat row number 54 to 60. The survivors were seriously injured with bone fractures at parts different for each due to strong impact from the crash and subjected more or less to a traumatic shock which would require 2 to 6 months to recover completely. Now that sounds painful, it sounds scary. I mean, imagine the PTSD and the survivor's guilt that these people had after surviving this crash. It's crazy. The investigators divided the debris by seat row number A, which is the upper deck seats, aka rows number 1 to 8, B, the row numbers 10 to 18, aka until the 9th row, C, row numbers 19 to 31, aka the 13th row, D, row numbers 32 to 42, aka the 11th row, and E, row numbers 43 to 60, aka until the 18th row. Bodies in A and B were recovered mainly at the crash point as well as its vicinity, while bodies in C sections were near the top of the ridge because C section turned over B section subsequent to crash of the damaged airframe. Bodies in D section were recovered in an extensive area right to the right forward slope of the ridge. Bodies in E section, which fell down to the dale together, where the damaged airframe were recovered concentrated within a narrow area with relatively less damage. The four survivors were also rescued from the section, aka the E section. So bodies found in sections A and D were found to be burnt and had experienced carbonization. They suffered severe shock from the breakage of the airframe and the heat of the fire. The bodies found in section E suffered little cosmetic damage. However, and this is a trigger warning that I'm going to give to you right now so you can just skip a couple of seconds. But like these people, they suffered from bruising, brain damage, and or busting of internal organs. These injuries resulted in instantaneous or near instantaneous death, excluding the survivors, of course. And to me, honestly, this just doesn't sound human whatsoever. and it sounds so painful. And the fact that there might be a possibility that these people survived the crash and they were alive and then they succumbed to their injuries is very disturbing and it's very, very saddening. On the day of the accident, Honshu Island and its vicinity were covered by a Pacific light, but the atmosphere in these areas was somewhat unstable. The thunderclouds were formed in the afternoon hours in Tokyo's metropolis and the western part of Satayama Prefecture and the northern part of Gunma Prefecture. Heavy rain accompanied by the thunderstorms were observed, as much as 38 millimeters at Banba in Gunma Prefecture and 30 millimeters at Ogunchi of Tokyo metropolis for 1 hour from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. The thunderclouds over the western part of Satayama Prefecture developed as high as 13,000 meters or 4,250 feet at maximum at about 5 p.m. and a heavy rainfall of 58 millimeters were observed at Shichibu City for 1 hour from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. However, the thunderclouds declined thereafter, decreasing their height from 6,000 meters at 6 p.m. and further weakened at 7 p.m. The rain at Shichibu City ceased to fall, and rainfall in some parts of Gunma, Satayama, and Nagano prefectures were limited to several millimeters for an hour from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Basically, what I can gather from this is that the weather really wasn't a factor or a cause in this accident. So before I started talking about the story of Japan Airlines Flight 123, I did mention that there was a 1978 hail strike incident that I told you to keep at the back of your head. So as I'd mentioned, the repairs were done by both the airline and Boeing, and the repair was seen to be proper maintenance. When the lower half of the AFT pressure bulkhead deformed by accident was removed and was being replaced by the new one, it was found by an inspector of the Boeing company that there were locations where the edge mounting around the rivet holes of the splice surface or the left 18 splice between webs of the upper half and the lower half of the bulkhead was less than value specified in the structural repair manual. Which for me, I think it sounds like they were cheapening out on their materials, and we are going to find out why. And this edge margin may have been caused by one or a combination of the following. A, a disorder in the alignment of the rivet hole. B, a deformation of the upper and lower half of the bulkhead. C, a deformation of the AFT position of the fuselage due to shock caused by the accident, the 1978 one. And D, a deformation caused by the removal of a part of the AFT portion of the fuselage for the repair work. And to prevent the airframe from deforming, one could still add additional jacks into the AFT fuselage, but the deformation might have still happened. It might have been possible to use special tools in order to prevent the fuselage from deforming. It might have been possible to use special tools in order to prevent the fuselage from deforming and to facilitate the installation of the lower half of the AFT pressure bulkhead, but no such work was carried out, which is very, very, very scary. To make things even worse, after the 1978 tail strike incident, the accident aircraft underwent an incident at the time of landing at Shitose Airport in August 1982. In which number 4 engine struck the runway, but it was repaired and the engine and the engine cowling. However, none of these are considered as relevant to this accident. In my opinion, it's a little bit relevant, but it's okay. And with regards to the L18 splice, fatigue cracks at L18 splice began to generate immediately after the repair of the bulkhead and propagated on whole edges of a half of the rivets with repetition of flight, reaching as much as about 280 millimeters or 11 inches in total length immediately before the accident. So it is said that the splice ruptured during the flight, thus resulting in a rapid decompression. It is estimated that this accident was caused by a deterioration of flying quality and loss of primary flight control functions due to a rupture of the AFT pressure bulkhead of the aircraft and the subsequent ruptures of a part of the fuselage tail, vertical fin, and hydraulic flight control systems. The reason why the AFT pressure bulkhead was ruptured in flight is estimated to be that the strength of the said bulkhead was reduced due to the fatigue cracks propagating at the splashed portion of the bulkhead's webs to the extent that it became uncontrollable to endure the cabin pressure in flight at that time. The initiation and propagation of the fatigue cracks are attributable to the improper repairs of the said bulkhead conducted in 1978, and it is estimated that the fatigue cracks, having not been found in the later maintenance inspection, is contributive to their propagation, leading to the rupture of the said bulkhead. So the recommendation set out by the NTSB, surprisingly. A, there should be a change in the design of the empennage. B, these aeroplane businesses should modify the designs of their hydraulic systems so that they are damaged in the event of another decompression. C, they should revise the inspection program with regards to the AFT pressure bulkhead. And D, the NTSB and other organizations need to issue a maintenance alert bulletin to persons responsible for the engineering of approval of the repairs. And that is the end of today's episode. I know it was long, and I also know that I'm not being as consistent as I am supposed to be. Apologies for that. It's just that a lot of these episodes take really, really, really long to get them together with researching, recording, editing, and then uploading. It takes too much time, and I know you're just going to have to at least a little bit respect to understand that. Which is why I also really, really heavily plug the Patreon, because I think then that is a way to, at least the money that I could make from Patreon, I could use it to hire another person who will help me research, who will help me edit that type of stuff so that we have more episodes coming to you. But until then, we're just gonna have to be stuck with these haphazard episodes. I know it breaks my heart too. If you'd like to support the podcast, the links will be in the description on YouTube and in the show notes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, so much more. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for being patient, and I'll catch you in the next one. Cheers.